I finally managed a thin smile. Well, she's right about that. Don't let her do too much right now. Hard to keep her down. Well, tie her if you have to, Kayla Cole said. And then she laughed. I didn't. Couldn't right then. I knew a fair amount about heart disease from my days at Johns Hopkins. I would definitely keep a closer watch on Nana. What about you, Dr. Coles? What about your work schedule? Nearly 10 o'clock and you still have more house calls. She shrugged and seemed a little embarrassed by the question. I'm young, I'm strong, and I believe the people in these neighborhoods need decent, affordable health care. So that's what I'm providing, trying to. Good night, Alex. Take good care of your grandmother. Oh, I will. I promise. The road to hell, she said, paved with good intentions. She nodded and walked off the porch. Say good night to everybody for me. Dr. Coles headed down Fifth Street to her final appointment of the day. Chapter 88. I did some more background work on the three blind mice the next day. Taped notes to my wall in the attic, but I couldn't get into it. Couldn't concentrate worth a damn. Nana's lab tests came back in the afternoon, and as Kayla Coles had promised, she called the house. The two of us had a talk on the phone after she spoke to Nana. I just wanted to thank you for your help, I said as I got on the line. I'm sorry if I was rude in our living room the other night. What makes you think you were rude? You were a little frightened, is all. I don't think rude is part of your makeup. Anyway, let me tell you about your grandmother. She is suffering from atrial fibrillation, but given the options, that's not such bad news. Tell me why I should be happy about it, I said. Not happy, but the treatment is non-invasive and has a good success rate. I think we can treat her with a catheter ablation. We'll start there. She'll be able to go home the next day and hopefully be her old self in a week. When should she go in for the procedure? I asked. That's up to her. I wouldn't wait more than a couple of weeks. She sounded a little stubborn when I brought up a hospital stay. Says she's too busy. I'll talk to her, see if it helps. What do we do until then? Just baby aspirin, believe it or not. 181 milligram tablet a day. She also has to limit her caffeine, coffee, and tea. And Nana should avoid stress-related situations. Good luck on that one. That's it? I asked. For now, yes. Please watch the stress on her. I'll stay involved if she wants me to. I know she does. Kayla Coles laughed. Good. She's a smart woman, isn't she? We're going to make sure she sees 100. I laughed. I hope I get to see her reach 100. So, no special precautions until we go in for the procedure? No, not really. Just try not to bring too much excitement into her life. I'll do my best, I said. You do your best, and try not to get shot, said Kayla Coles, before she hung up. Chapter 89. No way I was going to get shot staying at home, or so I believed. A couple of mornings after my conversation with Dr. Kayla Coles, I came downstairs to make breakfast for the kids. Nana was sitting at her spot at the kitchen table, a large brown mug steaming in front of her. Uh-uh, I wagged a finger at her. Decaffeinated, she said. Don't start in on me, Alex. Nope, I won't even say that you're a little touchy this morning. Sleep okay? Nobody my age sleeps okay. I did set up an appointment for the catheter ablation. I go in a week from today. Happy? She asked. Very happy, I said, then gave her a hug, which Nana returned in kind. Dr. Kayla was right. She was strong for her age. Later that morning, I had a pretty good talk with FBI Director Burns. He told me he had someone trying to track the email from Foot Soldier, but so far, no luck. He asked if I'd given serious consideration about his offer to work at the Bureau. I'd been expecting the question. I've thought about it some. My life is suddenly a little complicated. For one thing, I need to get some kind of closure on this case with the Army. They helping or getting in the way? The army, Burns asked. A little of both. I've met some good people. Army's like everybody else, though. They want to solve their own problems. There's something incredibly nasty going on with this murder case. They know it, and so do I. I feel it in my bones. There will be more murders. That's my fear. If I can help, Burns said. No strings attached, Alex. This is a big case. I think it's important, too. I appreciate that. After I got off the phone, I went in search of Nana. She was futzing around in the kitchen, as usual. Her kitchen, her house. I need a rest. So do you, I said to her. Where do you want to go after your procedure? Paris, Nana said without blinking an eye. Then maybe Rome. Venice, of course. Florence would be real nice. Then come home through London. Stop in and see the Queen. What do you think? Sound too rich for your blood? Maybe you were thinking of a train ride to Baltimore, she asked, and laughed at her own joke. She was a funny lady, always had been. I have some money put away, I told her. Me too, she said. Mad money. What about Jamila? What about your job? If Jamila could take some time off, that would be great. She likes her job, though. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? How's your marble collection? Maybe you should buy a couple of jars for her. I laughed. Then I went over and put my arms around Nana again. Couldn't help myself lately. I love you, old woman, I said. I don't tell you that enough, and when I do, it isn't with the passion I feel. That's nice to hear, she said. You can be so sweet sometimes. I love you too, and I always say it with the passion that I feel. You feeling all right? I asked. Today's good. Tomorrow, who knows? She shrugged. I'm making some lunch. Don't ask if you can help. I am fine. Still on the right side of the grass. After lunch, I went upstairs to my office in the attic to think about what my next step should be. There was a fax waiting. I wagged my finger at it. It was a copy of a news story in the Miami Herald. I read about the execution the night before of a man named Tichter at the Florida State Prison in Stark. Abraham Tichter had been in Vietnam, Special Forces. Scrawled at the bottom of the fax was the following.
Innocent of these murders in Florida. Wrongfully accused, convicted, and executed. Abraham Tichter makes 6, in case you aren't keeping count. Foot soldier.
I was keeping count. Chapter 90. Ever since Nana had been under the weather, I'd been doing the grocery shopping and most of the household chores. Usually I took little Alex with me to the small Safeway on 4th Street. That's what I did early in the afternoon. I carried him high on my shoulders, out the kitchen door, and down the driveway to my car. Alex was giggling and yapping, as he always is. The boy never shuts up or sits still. He's a bouncing ball of pure energy, and I can't get enough of him. I was absently thinking about the last message from Foot Soldier, so I don't even know why I happened to notice the black Jeep traveling down 5th. It was moving at around 30, right about the speed limit. I don't know why I paid it much attention, but I did. My eyes never left it as it came toward little Alex and me. Suddenly, the barrel of a black tech protruded through the side window of the Jeep. I pulled down the baby, then dropped to the ground, whipping my body sideways to avoid landing on Alex. The shooting started. Pop, 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 pop. I bellied across the lawn, shielding my baby under my left arm, and then dragged him behind a shade tree. I needed cover between us and the gunman. I didn't get a good look inside the Jeep, but I did see that the driver and the shooter were white. 2 of them, not 3. I couldn't tell if they were the men from Rocky Mount. Who else could it be, though? The shooters from West Point? Were they the same? What was happening now on 5th Street? Who had ordered it? Pop, 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 pop. Bullets cracked into the walls of the house, and a front window shattered. I had to stop the attack somehow. But how? I crawled to the porch and made it just before another round of fire. Pop, 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 pop. Unbelievable, even for Southeast. I pushed Alex down behind the porch. He was screaming bloody murder now. Poor frightened little boy. I kept him down on the ground, then lifted my head and got a quick peek at the Jeep stopped in front of my house. Pop, pop, pop. Pop, 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 pop. I returned fire. Three carefully aimed shots so as not to hit someone in the neighborhood. Then two more shots. Yes. I knew that I got the shooter. Possibly in the chest, but maybe the throat. I saw him jerk back hard and then slump over the seat. No more shots came. Suddenly, the Jeep took off, tires screeching, shimmying as it skidded around the nearest corner. I carried Alex inside and herded Nana and the baby into her room. I made them stay down on the floor. Then I called Samson, and he was at the house in minutes. I was just about past being shocked and afraid for my family when I became as angry as I'd ever been. My body shook with rage and the need for retaliation. A lot of broken windows, some bullet holes in the walls. Nobody hurt, Samson said after a quick walk around the house. It was a warning. Otherwise, I think they would have killed me. They came to the house to deliver a message. Just like when we went to Starkey's house in Rocky Mount. Chapter 91. It was just past 4 in the morning when Thomas Starkey waltzed out of the kitchen door of his home. He walked across a dewy patch of lawn, then climbed into his blue Suburban. It started right up. Starkey always kept it in perfect condition, even serviced it himself. I'd like to take a few pot shots at the fucker right now, Samson said at my side. We were parked in deep shadows at the end of the street. Blow out a few windows in his house. Spread a little terror his way. Hold that thought, I said. A few minutes later, the Suburban stopped and picked up Warren Griffin, who lived nearby in Greystone. It drove on to Knob Hill and picked up Brownlee Harris. Then the Suburban sped out of Rocky Mount on U.S. 64, headed in the direction of Raleigh. None of them look shot up, Samson said. That's too bad. So who'd you shoot on 5th Street? I have no idea. Complicates things, though, doesn't it? These three know something, though. They're in this conspiracy we've been hearing about. The Silent Gray Wall? That's the one. Seems to work pretty well, too. I didn't have to follow too closely. Didn't even have to keep the Suburban in sight. Earlier that morning, about 3 o'clock, I'd slapped a radio direction finding device under the vehicle. Ron Burns was helping me in any way he could. I'd told him about the shooting at my house. I kept a good distance behind the killers. The Suburban stayed on U.S. 64 past Zebulon, then I-40 to 85 South. We went by Burlington, Greensboro, Charlotte, Gastonia, and then entered South Carolina. Samson sat beside me on the front seat, but he'd fallen asleep before we got to South Carolina. He had worked a shift the day before and he was exhausted. He finally woke up in Georgia, yawned, and stretched his big body as best he could in the cramped space.
Where are we?
Livonia.
Oh, that's good news. Where's Livonia?
Near Sandy Cross. We're in Georgia. Still hot on their trail.
You think this is another hit coming up?
We'll see. At Doraville, we stopped at a diner and had breakfast. The state-of-the-art device attached to the Suburban was still tracking. It seemed unlikely that they'd find it at this point. The breakfast, cheese omelets, country ham and grits, was a little disappointing. The diner looked just about perfect, and it sure smelled good when we walked inside, but the generous portions were bland, except for the country ham, which was too salty for me.
You gonna follow up with Burns? Maybe become an FBI man?
Samson asked, after he'd downed his second coffee. I could tell he was finally waking up. I don't know for sure. Check with me in a week or so. I'm a little burned out right now. Like this food. Samson nodded.
It'll do. I'm sorry I got you involved in all this, Alex. I don't even know if we can bring them down. They're cocky, but they're careful when they need to be.
I agreed. I think they did the hit solely for money. But that doesn't explain enough. What happened to start the killing? Who's behind it?
Who's paying the bills? Samson's eyes narrowed. The three of them got a taste for killing in the war. Happens sometimes. I've seen it. I put my knife and fork down and pushed the plate away. No way could I finish off the omelet and ham. I'd barely touched the grits, which needed something. Maybe cheddar cheese, onions, sautéed mushrooms? I owe you. This is big debt, Alex, Samson said. I shook my head. You don't owe me a thing, but I'll probably collect on it anyway. We went back out to the car and followed the signal for another 2 hours. The trip had taken from morning into the early afternoon. We were on I-75, which we took to US 41, and then Old 41. Then we were on some narrow, meandering country road in Kennesaw Mountain National Park. We were following three killers in northern Georgia, about an 8-hour drive from Rocky Mount, close to 500 miles. I passed the turnoff the first time and had to go back. A turkey vulture was sitting there watching us. The woods around here were heavily forested, and the foliage was thick and ornery-looking. The RDF indicated that the Suburban was no longer moving. We ought to park somewhere along the main road, hide the car as best we can, then walk on in through the woods, I said. Sounds like a plan. I hate the fucking woods, though. I found a little turnoff that would keep the car hidden. We opened the trunk and took out a duffel bag, as well as guns, ammo, and night vision goggles for each of us. NVGs. Then we walked about half a mile through the thick woods before we could see a small cabin. Smoke was curling out of a field stone chimney. A very cozy spot. For what, though? A meeting of some kind? Who was here? The cabin was near a small lake that was fed by the headwaters of the Jacks River. At least that was how it was marked. A stand of hemlocks, maples, and beech trees enveloped the clearing in deep green. Some of the trees were easily 6 feet wide. The blue Suburban was parked in front of the cabin, but so was a silver Mercedes station wagon. It had North Carolina plates. They've got company. Who the hell is this? Samson asked. Maybe we caught a break. We saw the front door open, and Colonel Thomas Starkey stepped outside. He had on a green t-shirt and baggy fatigue pants. Right behind him was Mark Sherman, Cumberland County's district attorney. Christ! It was the lawyer who had prosecuted and convicted Ellis Cooper for 3 murders that he didn't commit. Chapter 92. What the hell is this? You know who he is? Samson asked. His temperature was rising fast. I remember him. Like you said, maybe we caught a little break. But why would Mark Sherman be here? Samson and I were crouched behind a couple of ancient beech trees about 100 yards from the cabin. The forest was eerily dark and seemed almost primitive. The roots of the huge trees all around us were carpeted by small ferns. On the walk there, our legs got a good lashing from the catbriar and the blackberry stickers. We're in deep shit somewhere around Kennesaw, Georgia. We traveled a lot of hours to get here. Now what? John asked. Now we wait. We listen, I said. I reached into the cloth duffel bag and pulled out a black box attached to what looked like a silver wand. The apparatus was a long-distance microphone, compliments of my new good buddies at the Bureau. Samson nodded when he saw what it was. FBI wants you real bad. I nodded back. That they do. This is a state-of-the-art unit, but we should get a little closer. We made our way up toward the cabin, crawling on our hands and knees between the towering trees. Besides the long-distance mic, Samson and I had rifles and 9mm Glocks. Take one of these, I said, in case you don't like the NVGs. I handed him a pocket scope that worked in day or night. Fully extended, it was less than 6 inches long. Another valuable loan from the FBI. Only fair, I guess, Samson said. The boys probably have a couple of war toys of their own inside that log cabin. That's what I was thinking. It's the argument I used with Burns. That and the fact that they came after me at my house. Burns has 3 kids of his own. He was sympathetic. Samson glanced over at me. I thought you didn't know it was them in Washington, he whispered. I don't. I'm not so sure it was. I had to tell Burns something. I don't know that it wasn't them. Samson grinned and shook his head. You're going to get fired before you get hired.
I stayed close to the ground and trained one end of the mic at the cabin. We were only 50 yards away now. I worked the microphone around until the voices got as clear as if they were just a few feet away from us. I recognized Starkey's voice.
Thought we'd party a little tonight, Counselor. Tomorrow we're going to hunt deer up on the mountain, you in? I have to get back tonight,
said Mark Sherman.
No hunting for me, I'm afraid.
There was a brief silence, then a burst of laughter. Three or four men joined in. Brownlee Harris spoke up.
That's just fine, Sherman. Take your blood money and run, why don't you? You hear this one? The devil takes a meeting with his lawyer. I heard it,
said Sherman.
Funny, Mark. Now listen, devil is slick as shit, you know. I mean, you know, right, Counselor? Devil says, I'll make you a senior partner right now, today, young Turk lawyer asks. What do I have to do? Devil says, I want your immortal soul. Beat. And also the immortal souls of everyone in your family. The young lawyer stops and thinks, and he eyes the devil something fierce. And then the lawyer says, what's the catch?
There was raucous laughter from inside the cabin. Even Sherman joined in.
That's even funny the fourth time. You do have the rest of my money,
he asked once the laughter had stopped.
Course we do. We've been paid and you're going to be paid in full. We keep our deals, Mr. Sherman. You can trust us. We're men of honor.
Suddenly, I heard a loud noise off to the left of where we were crouched. Samson and I swiveled around in a hurry. What the hell was this? A red sports car was coming fast up the dirt road. Too fast.
Now, who the hell is this? Samson asked in a whisper. More killers? Maybe the shooters from Washington? Whoever it is, they're moving.
We watched as the red car bounced up the badly rutted dirt road. It pulled in behind the Suburban, screeching to a stop. The front door of the cabin opened. Starkey, then Harris, stepped outside onto the porch. The doors of the sports car were flung open simultaneously, almost as if the action were choreographed. Two dark-haired women stepped out. Asian and very pretty. They were wearing skimpy tops and short skirts. Both had on outrageous shoes with high heels. The driver held up a bottle in silver wrapping paper, smiled, and waved it at Starkey.
Chao Mong, da den voi to am, gu chung toi,
Starkey called from the front porch.
Vietnamese, Samson said. Starkey said something like, Welcome to our hooch.
Chapter 93. We had been observing the rustic cabin for more than 2 hours, and now we watched the sun dip behind the mountains. It had gotten much colder, and my body was feeling stiff, and I was tired from the drive. The wind whistled through the forest, whistled and sometimes roared. It felt as if it were blowing right through me.
We're gonna get them, Samson whispered hoarsely.
I think he was trying to cheer me up.
Maybe tonight, maybe not. They're making mistakes, Alex.
I agreed with that.
Yes, they are. They're not invincible. I'm not even sure they have the whole story themselves. They're just a piece of this.
We could hear them inside the cabin. Every word. Mark Sherman had apparently decided to stay for the party. Rock music echoed from the cabin. Janis Joplin was wailing, and one of the Asian women sang along. It sounded like bad karaoke, but nobody complained. Then the doors came on. Memories of Vietnam, I suppose. Occasionally, someone would pass by a window. The Asian women had both taken off their tops. The taller of the two stepped outside for a few minutes. She smoked a joint, taking greedy puffs. Harris came out and joined her. They spoke English on the porch of the cabin.
I used to know your mama-san,
he said, and giggled.
You're kidding.
The girl laughed and blew out jets of smoke.
Of course you're joking. I get it, sort of.
She looked to be in her late teens, maybe early 20s. Her breasts were large and too round, augmented. She wobbled slightly on her high heels.
No, I knew her. She was my hooch mama. I made it with her, and now I'm going to make it with you. See the irony?
The girl laughed again.
I see that you're stoned.
Well, there's that, too. My smart little dink. The thing is, maybe you're my daughter.
I tuned out on the conversation and stared at the outline of the A-frame cabin. It looked like some family's vacation house. We'd heard that the three of them had been using the place since the mid-80s. They'd already talked about murders committed in these woods, but it wasn't clear who had been killed or why, or where the bodies were buried. Jim Morrison was singing The End. The TV was on, a University of Georgia football game, Georgia versus Auburn. Warren Griffin was rooting loudly and obnoxiously for Auburn. Mark Sherman had apparently gone to Georgia, and Griffin was busting his chops. Samson and I stayed in a culvert a safe distance away. It was getting even colder, the wind screaming through the large hemlocks and beech trees. "Starkey doesn't seem to be partying," Samson finally said. "You notice that? What's he doing?" "Starkey likes to watch. He's the cautious one, the leader. I'm going to move a little closer. We haven't seen or heard from the other girl in a while. Makes me nervous." Just then, we heard Mark Sherman raise his voice.
"Jesus, don't cut her. Be careful. Come on, man. Put away the K-bar. Why the hell not cut her?"
Harris yelled at the top of his voice.
"What the hell is she to you? You cut her then. Try it. You'll like it. You cut her, counselor. Get your hands dirty for a change." "I'm warning you, Harris. Put the goddamn knife down. You're warning me? That's pretty rich. Here, take the knife. Take it. Here you go."
The lawyer groaned loudly. I was pretty sure he'd been stabbed. The girls began to scream. Sherman was moaning in excruciating pain. Chaos had taken over inside the cabin.
"Chakadao!"
Harris suddenly yelled in Vietnamese. He sounded a little nuts.
"Chakadao means kill," Samson told me.
Samson and I were up in a flash and sprinting full out toward the cabin. We reached the front door together. He went in first with his gun drawn.
"Police!" he yelled over the blaring rock music and TV. "Police! Hands in the air! Now!"
I was right behind Samson when Starkey opened up with an MP5. At the same time, Griffin fired a handgun from across the room. The two Asian women were screaming as they scampered out the cabin's rear door. They had enough street smarts to get out of there fast. I saw that the smaller woman had a deep gash across her cheek. Her face was dripping blood. Mark Sherman lay on the floor, motionless. There were dark splatters of blood on the wall behind the lawyer's body. He was dead. The big gun erupted again, noise and smoke filling the room. My ears were ringing.
"Move out,"
Sharkey yelled to the others.
Dim out,"
Brownlee Harris shouted and actually seemed to be laughing. Was he completely mad? Were they all insane? The three killers bolted out the back door. Warren Griffin covered the retreat with heavy fire. They didn't want a final shootout inside the cabin. Starkey had other plans for his team. Samson and I fired at the retreating men, but they made it out. We approached the back door slowly. Nobody was waiting there, and no more shots were fired at us for the moment. Suddenly, there was the sound of shooting away from the cabin. Half a dozen hollow pops. I heard the shrill screams of the two women cut through the trees. I peeked my head around the corner of the cabin. I didn't like what I saw. The two women hadn't made it to their car. Both lay on the dirt road. They'd been shot in the back. Neither of them moved. I turned to Samson. "They'll come back for us. They're going to take us out, here in the woods." He shook his head.
"No, they're not. We're going to take them out. When we see them, we open up. No warnings, Alex. No prisoners. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
I did. This was an all-or-nothing fight. It was war, not police work. And we were playing by the same rules they were.
Chapter 95.
It was awfully quiet all of a sudden. Almost as if nothing had happened. As if we were alone in the woods. I could hear the distant roar of the Jacks River and birds twittering in the trees. A squirrel scampered up the trunk of a hemlock. Otherwise, nothing moved. Nothing that I could see anyway. Eerie as hell. I was getting a really bad feeling. We were in a trap. They knew we would come here after them, didn't they? This was their turf, not ours. And Samson was right. This was war. We were in a combat zone behind enemy lines. A firefight was coming our way.
Thomas Starkey was in charge of the enemy, and he was good at this. All three of them were pros.
I think one woman is moving a little, he said. I'm going to go check on her, Alex.
We both go, I said. But Samson was already slipping away from the cover of the trees. John, I called, but he didn't look back. I watched him run forward in a low crouch. Samson was down close to the ground, moving fast. He was good at this. Combat. He'd been there, too. He was about halfway to where the women lay when gunfire erupted from the woods to his right. I still couldn't see anybody, just wisps of gun smoke wafting up into tree branches. Samson was hit, and he went down hard. I could see his legs and lower torso just over a bramble. One leg twitched. Then nothing. Samson didn't move anymore. I had to get to him somehow. But how? I crawled on my stomach to another tree. I felt weightless and unreal. Completely unreal. There was more gunfire. Pinging off rocks, thudding into nearby trees. I didn't think I was hit, but they'd come damn close. The fire was heavy. I could see wisps of smoke from the rifles rising to my right. I could also smell gunpowder in the air. It struck me that we weren't getting out of this one. I could see Samson where he lay. He wasn't moving. Not even a twitch. I couldn't get to him. They had me pinned down. My last case. I had said that right from the start. John, I called. John, can you hear me? I waited a few seconds, then called out again. John, move something. John? Please say something. Please move. Nothing came back to me. Except another round of heavy fire from the woods. Chapter 96. I hadn't experienced anything like the explosive rage, but also the fear that I felt. This happened in combat, I realized, and considered the irony. Soldiers lost buddies in the war and went a little mad, or maybe a great deal mad. Is that what had happened in the An Lao Valley? There was a noisy buzzing inside my head, bright flashes of color in front of my eyes. Everything around me felt completely surreal. John, I called again. If you can hear me, move something. Move a leg. John! Don't die on me, not like this, not now. He didn't move, didn't respond. There was no sign that he was alive. He didn't shiver or twitch. Nothing at all. More rifle fire suddenly erupted from the woods, and I hugged the ground, digging my face into leaves and dirt. I tried to put Samson out of my mind. If I didn't, I would wind up dead. I had a terrible thought about John and Billy. Then I let it go. I had to. Otherwise, I'd die out here for sure. Trouble was, I didn't see how I was going to outmaneuver three Army Rangers in the woods, especially on terrain they were familiar with. These were experienced combat veterans. So they didn't risk closing in on me right away. They'd wait until dark. Not too long from now, maybe half an hour. Then I was going to die, wasn't I? I lay behind a big hemlock and a lot of disconnected thoughts shunted through my head. I thought about my kids, how unprepared I was to die, and how I would never see them again. I'd had so many warnings, so many close calls, but here I was. I checked on Samson again. He still hadn't moved. I raised my head a couple of times, just for a second. I turkey-necked a look through the trees. There were no moving shadows in the woods. I knew they were there, though, waiting me out. Three Army assassins, led by Colonel Thomas Starkey. They'd been here before. They were patient as death itself. They had killed a lot of people, in the Army and out of it. I thought of something Samson had said before he went to help the two women. When we see them, we open up. No warnings, Alex. No prisoners. Do you understand what I'm saying? I understood perfectly. Chapter 97. Patience. This was a waiting game, right? I understood that much about tonight. I even knew the military jargon for what I had to do next. EE, evade and escape.
I studied the rough terrain behind me and saw that I could slide down into a hollow that would give me some cover, and also allow me to move laterally, east or west. I could change my position without their knowing it. That would give me a small advantage, and I'd take anything I could get right now. I felt that I was a dead man. I didn't see any way out of this right now, so the hollow or gully looked awfully good to me. I thought about Starkey, Griffin, and Harris, how good they were, how badly I wanted to bring them down, Starkey in particular. He was the smart one, the leader, the cruelest of the three. Then I thought of what Samson had said, "No prisoners." Only they had to be thinking the same thing. I started to slide backward. I call it a slide, but I was almost burrowing into the wet leaves and soft ground. At least I made it down into the hollow without being shot. Catbriar was stuck all over my legs and chest. I wasn't sure, but I didn't think I could be seen from the woods. No one shot me in the head, anyway. Not so far. That was a good sign, right? A victory in itself. I crawled sideways in the hollow, slowly, with my face pressed deep into the cold dirt and leaves. I couldn't breathe very well. I kept moving until I was a good 15 or 20 yards from my original position. I didn't risk looking up, but I knew my angle to the woods and the house had changed significantly. Could they be watching me from somewhere close by? I didn't think so. But was I right? I listened. I didn't hear a twig break or brush being pushed aside, just the steady whistle of the wind. I pressed my ear to the ground, willing to try anything for an advantage. It didn't help. Then I waited some more. Patience. Things Samson had told me about the Army Rangers surfaced in my head. Odd facts. They had supposedly killed 55 VC for every Ranger in the war. That was the story, anyway. And they took care of their own. In the Vietnam War, only one Ranger was listed MIA. All the others were accounted for. Every single one. Maybe they had gone, fled from the woods. But I doubted it. Why would they leave me here alive? They wouldn't. Starkey wouldn't allow it. I felt guilty that I'd left Samson, but I wouldn't let myself dwell on it. I couldn't think about him. Not now. Later. If there was a later.
When we see them, we open up. No warnings, Alex. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I moved again, circling to the northeast, I figured. Were they moving on me, too? I stopped. New position. I waited there some more. Every minute seemed like 10. Then I saw something move.
Jesus, what the hell?
It was a bobcat eating its own droppings. Maybe 20-25 yards away, unconcerned with me, in its own world. I heard someone coming, and he was very fucking close.
How had he gotten so close without my hearing him before? Shit, he was right on top of me.
Chapter 98.
Had he heard me too? Did he know I was right there, a few feet away?
I didn't dare breathe, or even blink my eyes. He moved again. Very slow, very careful. A professional soldier. No, a professional killer. It was a big difference. Or was there? I didn't move an inch.
Patience. No prisoners.
He was close, almost to the hollow I was lying in. He was coming for me. He had to know my position.
Which one of them was it? Starkey? Griffin? Harris?
Whom I had avoided crashing into during a softball game? Was he going to kill me now? Or would I kill him? Somebody was going to die in less than a minute. Who could it be?
Who was up there over my head?
I shifted my body so I'd see him the instant he came over the edge. Was that what he would do? What were his instincts? He'd done this kind of tracking before. I hadn't. Not in the woods. And not in a war zone. He moved again, inches at a time.
Where the hell was he going?
He was just about on top of me. I watched the uneven ridge of the hollow and held my breath, tried not to blink.
I felt the sweat streaming through my hair and down the back of my neck, down my back. An incredible cold sweat. The buzzing in my ears was back. Someone rolled over the edge. Brownlee Harris. His eyes widened when he saw me waiting there for him, my gun aimed at his face. I fired just one shot. Then there was a dark hole where his nose had been an instant before. Blood spurted from the center of his face. His M16 dropped from his hands. "No warnings," I whispered as I took the rifle. Were the others close behind him? I waited for them, ready as I'd ever be for a shootout. Sergeant Warren Griffin. Colonel Thomas Starkey. The woods were eerie. Silent again. I scuttled away under the cover of darkness.
Chapter 99. A three-quarter moon was out, and that was both good and bad news. I was sure they would come for me now. It seemed logical. But was my logic the same as theirs? I was back close to my original position in the woods. I thought so, anyway. Then I was certain. My eyes teared involuntarily. I saw Samson, lying still, right where he'd been shot. I could see the body clearly in the moonlight. And I started to shake. What had happened was finally hitting me with its full force. I swiped at my eyes. A fist seemed to clench my heart and hold it tight, wouldn't let go. I could see the dead women lying in the dirt road. Flies were buzzing around the bodies. An owl hooted from a nearby tree. I shuddered. In the morning, perhaps a hawk or turkey vultures would come to feed on the bodies. I slipped on the night goggles I'd brought with me. I hoped they would give me an advantage. Maybe not. Probably not. Starkey and Griffin would have the best, too. They worked for a company that manufactured high-tech equipment, didn't they? I kept reminding myself that I'd taken out Brownlee Harris. It gave me some confidence. He'd looked utterly surprised to see me. Now he was dead, his arrogance gone, exploded in an instant by a bullet. But how could I surprise Starkey and Griffin? They must have heard the shot. Maybe they thought it came from Harris. No, they had to know he was dead. For a couple of minutes, I considered a flat-out run. Maybe I could get to the road. I doubted it, though. More likely I'd be shot down trying. They were good at this, but Harris had been good too. He was experienced, and now he was lying dead in a ditch. I had his rifle in my hands. Patience. Wait on them. They have questions and doubts too. I watched Samson's body for another few seconds, then I had to turn away. I couldn't think about him now. I mustn't, or I would die too. I never heard it coming. A sudden blast of deafening gunfire. One or both of them had gotten between me and the cabin. I spun in the direction of the shots, then a voice pierced the darkness. Close behind me.
Put down the gun, Cross. I don't want to kill you, not just yet.
Warren Griffin was down in the hollow with me. I saw him now. He had a rifle aimed at my chest. He wore night goggles and looked like an alien. Then Thomas Starkey appeared, also wearing goggles. He was above the gully, staring down. He had an M16 aimed right at my face, and he was smiling horribly. His victory grin.
You couldn't leave it alone, asshole. So now Brownlee's dead. So's your partner,
said Starkey.
You satisfied yet?
He forgot the two women and the lawyer. I said. It was strange to be looking at Griffin and Starkey through the night vision goggles, knowing that they were seeing me the same way. I wanted to take them down so much it hurt. Unfortunately, that wasn't going to happen. What the hell happened in Vietnam? I asked Starkey. What started all of this? What the hell was it?
Everybody who was over there knows what happened. Nobody wants to talk about it. Things got out of hand.
Like what, Starkey? How did it get this bad?
At first, there was a rogue platoon on the loose. That's what we were told, anyway. We were sent to the An Lao Valley to stop them, to clean it up.
You mean murder our own soldiers? Those were your orders, Starkey? Who the hell is behind this? Why the murders now? I was going to die, but I still wanted answers. I needed to know the truth. Hell of an epitaph. Alex Cross died seeking the truth.
I don't even fucking know.
Starkey hissed.
Not all of it. I'm not gonna talk about it anymore either. Maybe what I'm gonna do is cut you into little pieces. That happened over there. I'll show you what was done in the Anlau Valley. See this knife? It's called a K-bar. I'm really good with it. I've had some practice recently.
I know you have. I've seen some of your butchery. Then the strangest thing I could ever imagine happened. It blew my wheels off, completely blew my mind into 1,000 pieces. I was staring past Starkey, but something was different in the background. At first I didn't know what, then I did, and my knees were weak. Samson was gone. I didn't see his body anyway. At first I figured I was just disoriented, but then I was sure I wasn't. His body had been over there, near a tall beech tree. Now it wasn't.
No warnings, Alex. No prisoners. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I heard his words echo inside my head. I could hear the exact sound of it. Put down your guns, I said to Starkey and Griffin. Drop them right now. Now. They looked puzzled, but Starkey and Griffin kept their guns aimed at me.
I'm gonna cut you everywhere,
Starkey said.
This is gonna take hours. We'll be here till morning, I promise.
Put down the guns. I heard Samson's voice before I saw him walk out from behind a beech tree. And a knife, Starkey. You're not cutting anybody. Warren Griffin spun around. 2 shots instantly caught him in the throat and upper chest. His gun went off as he fell over backward to the ground. Arterial blood pumped from his wounds as he died.
Starkey, no! I yelled. No!
Thomas Starkey had raised his gun at me. Then he took one high in the chest. It didn't stop him. A second shot stung Starkey in the side and spun him full around. A third blasted through Starkey's forehead, and he went down for good in a bloody heap. His gun and K-bar fell into the gully near my feet. His blank eyes stared into the night sky.
No prisoners.
Samson was weaving toward me. As he came forward, he rasped,
I'm okay. I'm okay.
Just before he collapsed into my arms. Part 5. 4 Blind Mice. Chapter 100. As it turned out, Jamila was a godsend after the shootings in Georgia. She called every day, often 2 or 3 times, and we talked until she could tell I was healing some. Samson was the one who'd been physically wounded, and he was healing now too, but I was the one who seemed hurt the most. There had been too much killing for too long in my life. Early one morning, Dr. Kayla Coles arrived at the house on 5th Street. She marched right into the kitchen where Nana and I were eating breakfast. What's that? She asked with an arched eyebrow, pointing an accusatory finger. It's decaf. Just terrible. A memory of real coffee and a bad one at that, Nana told her with a straight face. No. I'm talking about Alex's plate. What are you eating? I pointed out the ingredients for her. These are 2 eggs over easy. What's left of 2 hot sausage patties. Home fries, slightly burned. The remains of a homemade sticky bun. Good. You made this for him? She looked at Nana in horror. No, Alex made it for himself. He's been cooking most of the breakfast since my fainting spell. He's treating himself this morning because his big murder case is finally over. And he's feeling better. Then I take it you don't always eat like this? I smiled at her. No, doctor, I don't usually eat eggs, sausage, sticky buns, and greasy potatoes. I was almost killed down in Georgia, and I'm celebrating that I wasn't. I guess that I prefer death by breakfast. Care to join us? She laughed out loud.
I thought you'd never ask. I smelled something heavenly when I opened the car door. I followed it all the way to the kitchen door.
Kayla Coles asked a few questions about the case while she ate. A single egg, orange juice, just a bite of a sticky bun. I glossed over most of the details of the case, but I gave her a feel for the three killers and what they had done, and what I knew about why, which wasn't enough, but that's the way it goes sometimes.
"Where's John Sampson now?" she wanted to know.
"Manteloking, New Jersey," I said. "He's recovering from his wounds, among other things. He has a nurse. A live-in, I hear."
"She's his girlfriend," said Nana. "That's what he really needed anyway."
After breakfast, Dr. Coles gave Nana a physical right in the house. She took her temperature, pulse, blood pressure, listened to her chest with a stethoscope, then did a P&A. She checked for fluid buildup in Nana's ankles, the tops of her feet and hands, under her eyes. She looked into Nana's eyes and ears, tested her reflexes, looked at the color of her lips and nail beds. I knew all the elements of the test and possibly could have done the exam myself, but Nana liked getting visits from Kayla Coles. I couldn't take my eyes off Nana during the checkup. She just sat there, and she seemed like a little girl to me. She never said a word, never complained. When Kayla was finished, Nana finally spoke up.
"Am I still alive? I haven't passed, have I? Like that scary movie with what's-his-name, Willis?
Bruce Willis. No, you're still with us, Nana. You're doing beautifully." Nana took a deep breath and sighed.
"Then I guess tomorrow's the big day. Go in for my catheter ablation, my radio frequency ablation, whatever it is."
Dr. Coles nodded.
"You'll be in and out of the hospital in a snap. I promise you that."
Nana narrowed her eyes.
"You keep your promises?"
"Always," said Kayla Coles. Chapter 101. In the early evening, Nana and I took a ride out to Virginia in the old Porsche. She'd asked if we could take the drive, just the two of us. Aunt Tia was home with the kids.
"Remember when you first got this car? We used to take a ride just about every Sunday. I looked forward to it all week," she said, once we were out of Washington and on the highway.
"Car's almost 15 years old now," I said.
"Still runs pretty good, though," Nana said.
She patted the dash.
"I like old things that work.
Long, long time ago, I used to go for a car ride every Sunday with Charles.
This was before you came to live with me, Alex. You remember your grandfather?"
I shook my head. "Not as much as I'd like to. Just from the photographs around the house. I know the two of you came to visit in North Carolina when I was little. He was bald and used to wear red suspenders."
"Oh, those awful, awful suspenders of his. He had a couple of dozen pairs, all red."
She nodded. Then Nana seemed to go inside herself for a moment or two. She didn't talk about my grandfather very often. He had died when he was just 44. He'd been a teacher, too, just like Nana, though he taught math and she was English. They had met while working at the same school in Southeast.
"Your grandfather was an excellent man, Alex. Loved to dress up and wear a nice hat. I still have most of his hats. You go through the Depression. Things we saw. You like to dress up sometimes. Gives you a nice feeling about yourself."
She looked over at me.
"I made a mistake, though, Alex."
I glanced over at her.
"You made a mistake? This is a great shock. I'd better pull over to the side of the road."
She cackled.
"Just one that I can recall. See, I knew how good it could be to fall in love. I really loved Charles. After he died, though, I never tried to find love again. I think I was afraid of failing. Isn't that pathetic, Alex? I was too afraid to go after the best thing I ever found in this life."
I reached over and patted her shoulder. "Don't talk like you're leaving us."
"Oh, I'm not. I have a lot of confidence in Doc Kayla.
She would tell me if it was time for me to start collecting on all my old debts. Which I plan to do, by the way.
So this is a parable? A lesson?
Nana shook her head. Not really. Just an anecdote while we're taking this nice ride in your car. Drive on, young man. Drive on. I'm enjoying this immensely. We should do it more often. How about every Sunday?
The whole ride out to Virginia and back, we never once talked about Nana's procedure in the hospital the next morning. She obviously didn't want to, and I respected that. But the operation at her age scared me as much as any murder case could. No, actually it scared me more. When we got back to the house, I went upstairs and called Jamila. She was at work, but we talked for nearly an hour anyway. Then I sat down at my computer. For the first time since I got back from Georgia, I pulled up my notes on the three blind mice. There was still one big question I needed to answer, if I could. Big if. Who was behind the three of them? Who was the real killer?
Chapter 102.
I fell asleep at my work desk, woke up about 3 in the morning. I went down to my bedroom for a couple of hours. The alarm sounded at 5. Nana was scheduled to be at St. Anthony's Hospital at 6:30. Dr. Coles wanted her to be one of the first operations of the day, while everybody on the staff was fresh and alert. Aunt Tia stayed at the house with little Alex, but I brought Damon and Janny with me to the hospital. We sat in the typically antiseptic-looking waiting room, which really started to fill up with people about 7:30. Everybody in there looked nervous and concerned and fidgety, but I think we were probably right up there with the worst of the lot.
How long does the operation take? Damon wanted to know.
Not long. Nana might not have gone in first, though. It all depends. It's a simple procedure, Damon. Electrical energy is delivered to the AV node. The electricity is a little like the heat in a microwave. It disconnects the pathway between the atria and the ventricles and will stop the extra impulses causing Nana's irregular heartbeat. Got all that? Don't hold me to it, but that's fairly close to what's happening.
Is Nana wide awake while it's happening?
Janny wanted to know. Probably. You know your Nana. They gave her a mild sedative and then local anesthesia.
Won't touch her, Janny said.
So we talked and waited, fretted and worried, and it took longer than I thought it should. I tried not to let my mind wander to bad places. I wanted to stay in touch with the moment. I conjured up good memories of Nana, and they were a little like prayers. I thought about how much she had meant to me, but also to the kids. None of us would be where we were without Nana's unconditional love, her confidence in us, and even her needling, irritating as it could be sometimes.
When is she coming out?
Janny looked at me. Her beautiful brown eyes were full of uncertainty and fear. It struck me that Nana had really been a mother to all of us. Nana Mama was more Mama than Nana.
Is she all right? Damon asked. Something's wrong, isn't it? Don't you think this has taken too long?
Unfortunately, I thought so too. She's just fine, I said to the children. More time passed, slowly. Finally, I looked up and saw Dr. Coles coming into the waiting room. I took a quick breath and tried not to let the kids see how anxious and nervous I really was. Then Kayla Coles smiled. What a beautiful, glorious smile that was, the very best I've seen in a long while.
She's all right? I asked.
Aces, she said. Your Nana is a tough lady. She's asking for you already.
Chapter 103.
We visited with Nana in the recovery room for an hour. Then we were asked to leave. She needed to rest up. I dropped the kids off at school about 11 that morning. Then I went home to do a little more scut work in my office. I was looking into something for Ron Burns, a strange but intriguing case involving convicted sex offenders. In return, he'd gotten me some U.S. Army records that I wanted to check out. Some of it had come off ACIRS and RISS, but most came straight from the Pentagon. One of the subjects was the three blind mice. Who was the real killer? Who gave orders to Thomas Starkey? Who sanctioned the murders? Why were these particular men targeted? And most important, why were they set up instead of just having the three blind mice kill them? Was the goal to show them fear? Fear that they